You're listening to Saskia Unreserved on Channel 4.
A reminder, you're tuned into Rick Classic 88.2 with me, Saskia Constantinou, and we are also now streaming from Facebook with my very special guest from the Thalea Ensemble, James Baker, the conductor, also a percussionist, Karen Kim, violinist, Dr. Chris Gross, the cellist, and Adrian Morejon, the bassoonist and also executive director. Welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time ahead of a very busy day that you have with a concert this evening. You've already done an educational at the Shoe Factory, so thank you so much for being here. The Thalea Ensemble comprises 19 of New York's finest trained musicians and are heralded by the New York Times as a crucial part of New York's cultural ecosphere. I want to begin by asking, how and why was the Thalea formed back in 2008? And also to tell us about the meaning of Thalea, as it's a fairly obscure word. I found lots of different definitions.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you, Saskia, for having us on your show. We're grateful to be here, and we're excited to be performing for everyone here in Nicosia. The group was formed, as you said, in 2009. Actually, we met, even though many of us are based in New York, we met at the Lucerne Festival in Switzerland, which is sort of a hub for contemporary music. And at the time, we were mostly young college students, and we were invigorated and inspired by all of the wonderful music is being produced by composers of our time, living composers and composers of the recent past. So really it began as a passion project for performing contemporary music and music that is, you know, written for our generation. You asked about the word Thalea, and it's great that you mentioned that, because we will also be performing a piece tonight called Thalea by Gerard Griset. So that piece is a real masterwork, and it was a great inspiration for our group. And the word, I'm sure you found some definitions online, the word literally means, it's a Latin term meaning cutting, and it, the idea of splicing away and taking away elements. But also for us, that inspired the idea of cutting edge and things that are at the forefront, as well as being inspired by Griset and his legacy of music making.
Interesting. I found it as a repeated rhythmic pattern used in, say, certain types of late medieval European music, and also meaning morning dew.
And oh, it's that's also a new one. I hadn't actually heard that one before. That's I'm learning.
Part of Hebrew origin, and also it's a commune in Romania.
Yes.
Amazing.
So quite.
Well, and now there's actually a beer company in New York that is also called Thalea. So
wow. Oh,
lots of different meanings.
I can see a new sponsor coming up.
Exactly.
I like your mission, which states that you're, amongst other things, that you're cultivating curious listeners. How do you do that, and who is your focus?
So I think part of our mission is making sure is what the audience's experience is like at all our shows. And we really want them, as you probably read in our mission statement, our goals, is we want them to walk away with an experience that's memorable. And we are interested in audience members who are curious about music, and are interested in learning more about what music is being written today and what kind of sound worlds are possible. And so we're really excited about audiences who maybe have not heard a lot of contemporary music and are interested in the creativity that goes behind it.
Have you a particular focus on from an age bracket or not particularly? I mean, would you try to capture somebody maybe who's 60, 70?
I think Thalea has just celebrated our 15th anniversary this past season, which is nice to have it in alignment with the Contemporary Festival.
Absolutely. And 15 years from the Pharos as well.
So. Yes. Mm. And so I think over the years, our audience has changed a bit, and we have various age groups that have come to our concerts over the years. I think we are trying to be inviting to all age groups, but we were very interested in younger audience and trying to cultivate a new audience for the coming decades.
How do you do your research, and have you acquired data in order to define your audience?
We have a marketing and development director who spends quite a bit of time with the data from various concerts. We're trying to both continue our relationship with our existing audience that we've had over many years, and while simultaneously trying to grow and trying to reach out to new audience members. And so we do see that there is interest in audience members who have been with us for many years. And as our programming is evolving over the years to include more composers from various backgrounds and different styles, we are trying to expand the audience as well in that direction. And so I think it's an interesting game of doing both simultaneously.
What is your criterion for, and how do you go about finding out what your audience actually wants? Do you send them out questionnaires? Do you speak to them? How is the communication? I feel that this is such an important topic that's often overlooked by orchestras, ensembles, quartets.
Especially in these past couple of years, there's been a big effort in trying to get to know our audience more face-to-face and more talking to them after each concert, trying to find out which pieces resonate with them more so, and asking them directly what they want to hear. And, you know, for a long time, I think our repertoire was really based in living composers right around us in America, but also a lot of composers from Western Europe. And I think now we're starting to expand that based on desires from our audiences.
Right. Yes.
I'd love to just jump in and say I think that it's our audience, I think, also comes to us curious, and they want to be introduced to new things. And I think it's so important to us as a group to have these strong connections with composers that we think are always developing, always curious in the way that they listen and that they create, and that, you know, we're all part of the great adventure of experiencing something new.
What do you think contemporary music offers as a point of connection to the world around us?
I think, you know, the world we live in is constantly changing. And, you know, we're faced with new challenges every day. And I think that we need to experience art in a new way also. The things that we need emotionally, the things that pique our curiosity are constantly evolving. And I think it's so exciting to be part of finding these new sounds and bringing these sounds to life.
When you talk about new sounds, describe those new sounds for us. What are they to you?
Sure. You know, some composers, I think, are finding new ways of using our instruments and new ways of combining sounds from our instruments. And oftentimes, some things that feel very new to us are the way that a composer will frame silence, which is one of the most exciting parts of performing, I think, when you have a piece that has an incredible world and the most impactful moment is silence. I think that that's a really special thing.
Can you elaborate on that a little?
Sure. I mean, I'm thinking of a specific example from Grisé's piece Talia that we'll be playing tonight, which is all about exploring the overtones of a single pitch. And it sounds somewhat scientific, but it's something we're all familiar with, the idea of resonance and the idea of, you know, the timbre of a sound. It begins with a very loud gesture, and then the cello plays a very long note where I'm actually pressing down on the string so hard that the sound becomes choked and almost scratchy without pitch, which of course if I was performing Bach would be somewhat undesired. But in this context it has a real it has a musical purpose that I think is extremely effective. Partially because it just that idea of going from a choked sound into a fully resonant sound is a very micro event that actually unfolds throughout the entire 15-minute work in a very dramatic way.
What is music?
That's a long time question. Mm-hmm. I know John Cage said music is perhaps an attitude, a way of listening.
Just because Karen said silence.
Mm, yeah, sure.
Is the silence the music? Because even if we just don't say anything now, I'm sure that the first thing that you can be aware of is the air conditioning.
Yeah.
I think music is a framework for listening deeply, and that there are so many ways to do that.
And I would also say that one of the amazing things about a live concert experience, but just music listening in general, is that I think it asks us as musicians, but it also asks the audience to listen in a very active way, which is something that oftentimes in our daily life we are not doing. We tend to block out sounds or not pay attention to what's going on around us in an auditory way. And so I find that when I'm highly engaged in a performance, whether I'm listening or performing, that one of the great pleasures is that you this heightened sense of listening, this heightened sense of awareness, which to your question about silence was John Cage's main innovation, which was the idea that the act of active listening itself is a musical act.
That's a difficult work to play on the radio.
Sure.
James?
I mean, I think for me, the whole idea of music is there should be absolutely no difference between any music, any genre from the beginning to now. It's basically all the same thing. So if you're listening to Grise, the theoretical practices are exactly the same as those that Rameau used, basically. I mean, he's just the overtone series, the idea of all those theoretical practices were what composers were thinking about in Western music since the very beginning. Mm. Since back to isorhythmic stuff, Talia, it's all the same. So for me, I've always felt like I'm certainly not on a mission, but it's to me the idea of presenting all music without difference. So
right.
That, you know, there shouldn't be like, oh, it's new music. I don't understand it. It sounds horrible. It's just, you know, to me, you can listen to classical music played badly, and that's horrible too. You know,
that's very true.
All great music is played well. It's great. So I don't go much for distinctions. I just worry about the affect and the emotion of it, and how it reaches.
And the effect, too.
Mm. The audience.
At the EBU plenary meeting, the European Broadcasting Union, we always discuss contemporary music. It's a challenge for radio. It's not only here in Cyprus, but generally around all the broadcasters. And I think that public broadcasters should probably be doing more. We're all in agreement that we need to be doing more, but one doesn't want to lose listeners because, unfortunately, James, the fact is that it's much easier to listen to Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake than it is to listen to Messiaen, Bartok, string quartets, never mind going even into 21st century music. What do you think it is that, as broadcasters, we should be doing to make it more accessible, to make it reached that pinnacle that you're striving for?
Just play more.
I think, if I may add to it, kind of going off of what Karen and Chris mentioned earlier, is this notion of what is music. When we're listening within a frame of, you know, dedicated listening, we focus on what is the emotion we're trying to get out of the music, and all these other elements that all existed in the music that is easier to listen to, perhaps, according to many people. However, you know, many of us were trained in music to play correct notes and correct techniques.
Yes.
And basically what we're doing is we're kind of, you know, erasing the box around that and doing extended techniques, different sounds, but still there's a lot of structure to it. So if we could focus on like what the composer is intending to do with structure or phrasing or other elements, I think it's just giving the listeners a little guidance on what to listen for and what emotions do they get out of it.
That's very important now, the guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there should be more emphasis placed on what people are actually listening to explain the music so that it becomes more familiar and that it's played frequently?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's two answers to that. There's the ideal where you want people to kind of figure it out for themselves, but I think they need the guidance in the beginning as an entry. And perhaps playing music that they are familiar with that has similar ideas to a contemporary work and showcasing how they have similarities and how we can listen to them the same way through these elements.
Mm. I think there's also so much fear around this idea of not understanding the music. And I think that it's really great to be empowered to not try to understand the music, but just let yourself experience it, because then you can get lost in the experience and also find what is piquing your curiosity and just kind of go to another place. I think lots of times people are looking for something familiar in music.
Yes.
And, you know, that we could also become more familiar with the experience of letting go and just letting things come to us.
Do you find, I personally find that that becomes much easier when I'm in the concert hall, not when I'm listening to it over the radio, which is why I ask about the dilemma of the broadcasting. Nothing beats the live concert and of being immersed there. So you're part of that entire experience. So when you talk about experience, I fully understand. And somehow, why is it that it's just so much easier? You have that connection with the musicians as well. It's not only an audio, but it's also a visual representation.
Right. I mean, I think there's something very special to the communal aspect of a live performance. And, you know, the great thing that you get to experience at the live performance is the story of the piece from the beginning to the end. And oftentimes when you turn on the radio, you're just kind of thrown in the middle.
Yes.
And for contemporary music, that can be very challenging because it's maybe not a familiar landscape.
Right.
And I would also just add to what Karen was saying, you know, just to your point about how music functions in a concert hall is very different than oftentimes how it functions on the radio or in broadcasting. You know, we might have a Haydn symphony on and not be fully attentive to it as we would be in a live concert. And I think that's okay. But I do recognize that, to your point about contemporary music specifically, that if you're not coming to it from a place of familiarity, that it could be challenging. But I also think that, you know, thinking about why does contemporary music need to exist? So much of you know, what composers are writing now are in response to everyday events, to political events. Even tonight, we're playing a piece by a Cypriot composer, Andreas Tsiartis, who wrote a piece in response to the 50th anniversary of the divisions here in this country. That doesn't exist in Beethoven, you know, that specific cultural response. So I think, you know, having just understanding that composers are expressing something, even though they might be using slightly different tools.
Right,
instead of traditional harmony, they might be exploring timbre in a different way or melody in a different way. But it comes from a place of wanting to express something.
Commissions, as you said, also form a central core of your work. And I wanted to ask, how do you select the composer and the budget? Because the budget is an important aspect, too. How do you put a value on a creation?
Yeah, that's a complicated question to answer. The budget side, obviously, it's case by case, depending on who we're working with, what's the context. Of course, you know, I think everyone's in agreement that we'd all love to have more funding available for any project. But I think what's more important is what is the commission... What is the purpose of the commission?
Yes.
Who is the composer? In many cases, there'll be composers we already have a relationship with and we're exploring further collaboration. Or in this case, two new composers that we're getting to meet through the Pharos Foundation. And actually, this program is part of a larger project that Talia has been working on these past couple seasons, called our Ambassadors Program, where each season we focus on a different country. And so having two new Cypriot composers for us is important, so we can share new works not only with the audience here, but back at home in New York as well.
This is groundbreaking that you're working with Cypriot composers now. This is your first
time? This is our first time. And so I think it's really important for our repertoire to have that included.
Budgets are pretty good in the U.S. I did a bit of research and found that $80 million, dear listeners, not one, not 500 euros, not 100 euros, which is our amounts that we hear about, or even no funding at all. Nonprofits donate, together with private foundations, the New York State Council and the Office of the Governor. Do you tap into that funding and look generally around? Does it generate a lot of paperwork?
We are tapping into it, but there are many organizations and ensembles in the U.S. in the arts, and so it is spread out quite a bit. So I think all of our reaction, hearing you say how much that is in comparison, is great. But for us, we don't experience it that much as one organization,
yes,
because it is spread out. But we are very fortunate to get the funding that we do, and we do get funding from both governmental and private foundations, and that's really helpful.
The private foundations are quite prolific in the U.S. Why do you think that is, and do you see that it's an aspect that has grown?
Well, I think
I ask that particularly because in the Cyprus context, there are almost no private foundations who actually give towards culture.
Yeah,
and it's an ongoing fight, and the government's criterion are also very difficult to understand.
I see. Well, I can't speak to how things work here in Cyprus, but in America, the donation structure is largely a product of the tax code, actually. As a nonprofit organization in the United States, we are able to receive donations, and those donations are tax deductible for individuals and foundations. So there is that simple rule has created a mechanism for many benefactors to give and give generously, as well as the fact that I think if you compare the budgets of United States ensembles to a European group, I think my sense is that in Europe, a larger proportion of their funding comes directly from the government, as opposed to private individuals or private foundations.
Mm. What is it that makes the ensemble want to expand their musical knowledge? Is it a natural progression for you on which composers, for example, will stand out for you and you'll say, wow, we need to have that guy on board or that woman on board? And what makes it good for you? Because it's such a subjective...
Sure, it's subjective, but I think sometimes, we could speak about one of our initiatives that we've started the last couple of years, which is an early commissioning grant, which we give to a young composer who's sort of up and coming. I mean, we recently had our latest round, and I don't know if I can speak publicly about it, but I can say that we received 500 applications.
Wow.
And we, as an ensemble, were able to, review these applications. And I will say personally that I was floored by the amount of quality and just music and projects that I couldn't have even dreamed of. And it's hugely inspiring and pleasurable to discover these new things.
Is it from a melodic, a rhythmic, a unique perspective? Is it the instrumentation, electronic? I'm trying to just find what is that X factor.
For me, the X factor is very simple. It's what the music makes me feel. And composers get to that in so many different ways, and they all have their own voice. Some get through it through the melody, some through harmony, some through their rhythmic structure. But at the end of the day, there is that thing that will make you feel something or not.
And also, I think you know, there is a craft to composition, and I certainly think that's a part of it. But to your point about having an X factor, some composers create things that I just couldn't have even imagined. And there's something about that creative spark that some people have and have developed in a high, you know, in a large way. And when you see that combination of creativity and craft together, you oftentimes kind of know, you sense right away. And right. And it's amazing to see how many young composers are out there doing that.
Right. Anne-Sophie Mutter said notation is such a poor device to translate what the composer really wants. And I thought that was quite on the mark. Mm-hmm. Is all the music that you receive very clearly notated?
There's a huge variety, but most of it is, yes. But composers use notation as a tool in lots of different ways. And so sometimes a piece might be notated using, you know, graphical notation, you know, pictures essentially, and with certain rules that we're following. Maybe it's more open-ended or improvisatory, but a lot of times the compositions we receive are very highly precise.
But one of the most exciting things that we get to do is work with the composer, so right. We can get beyond the notation, which is, you know, one of the great privileges of playing new music.
You've preempted my next question, which was a little about that collaboration between composer and performer. If, for example, you have to play something on the violin that you don't want to tap your violin, for example, you don't want to, you know, hit the hill bow on the Strad, where is there a cutoff point for you? I'm sure. Just saying about the violin in particular.
Sure, and I find that composers are very respectful, but you know, you never want to be doing something that's going to damage the instrument, right? Mm-hmm. There are parts of the instrument that you replace anyway, the hair, the strings, you know.
Yes.
I'm very open to experimenting with all of that, but I've never met a composer who wants me to damage my instrument.
If I might add to that, in kind of both questions, is that unlike maybe decades ago, there was a precedent set where a composer gave music to an ensemble, and that was like the end product. And then the ensemble would just do what they can with that score. And I think in the past years, there's a move more to collaboration and spending more time with the composers. And so notation is just a draft. It's just a version. And a lot of our rehearsals is actually helping the composer also work on notation and update the notation and then seeing what techniques can come out of it. Because half the time, I think we've all had that experience where they explain the sound to us and we'll end up doing a completely different technique than they originally thought they would want. And sometimes that moment of workshop is the most important.
Yes. Mm-hmm. James, did you want to say something?
Not necessarily, but the
I see you're the quiet man of the ensemble.
I am.
You direct with your arms.
Exactly. I'm in a few words. No, I think I echo what these other folks have said. I mean, the collaboration with the composer, alive, is key. And the fact that we have that privilege is what makes most of what we do worth it, because it's really a privilege. And a lot of other music making, they're playing music as if it wasn't written by a composer somehow, that the composer is erased from the equation. It's just sort of like, oh, we're playing the Beethoven quartet, or we're playing a Bach piece, but we're not really thinking about who was Beethoven, you know, who was Bach when they walked in a room? What was he expecting to hear, or what was he surprised by, and what was the contribution that their musicians made to them? What were they expanded by, you know, what their thought process was most likely expanded by the players they were working with, you know? So we have that privilege, and we're always in the presence of the composer, and it's the composer is paramount
right.
to our thinking, and we have a healthy respect for composition.
How important is it for composers to have a musical language? Anne-Sophie Mutter, in this discussion on Penderecki's music, refers to his writing being so pertinent to musical history. And I think it was you, Chris, who said about composers like Andreas Czartas writing about contemporary, well, this one is about the 1974 invasion. How important is that? Do you believe that many today's composers are writing in a vacuum?
Well, I know every composer is probably different, but I do believe that most composers are responding to some aspects of the broader culture, and for their own, you know, personal interests or inspirations. I do think that, you know, one important thing to maybe point out is that a lot of the music of the last 50 years or 75 years came out of a place of great upheaval and tragedy, even in the post-World War II environment, where many composers in the midst of the great destruction of World War II ask themselves, can we really go back to writing music like Tchaikovsky? Is that appropriate when we see where some of that culture has led to? And for many of them, the response was no, and they decided that they needed to be radical in their approaches. And that radical approach, I think, continues to this day. And there's many explorations by those composers in terms of technical approaches, in terms of ways of approaching the instrument or ways of exploring sound that have continued to evolve out of that moment. And I think for young composers today, many of them are using that tradition for their own purposes, but many of them are, you know, exploring new things that are unique to this time: multimedia, social media, technology, things that are very much of the present moment, and exploring it in equally revolutionary and expressive ways.
Many premieres in tonight's concert, both Cyprus premieres and world premieres. Can you talk to us a little about the importance of program notes? Because I've been fortunate that I've got the program notes ahead of tonight's concert. And for example, George Christofi writes about his work, Giglos Circle in Greek, for flute, clarinet, bassoon, violin, viola, cello, and piano. And he writes, the work serves as a reflection on the perpetual motion between stability and transformation, embodying the ever-shifting nature of cycles within a closed system. In this case, a closed system of sounds. Do you think that that helps the audience to understand what they're going to hear? I can't imagine, for example, from that, what his work is going to sound like. Mm-hmm. Karen, you have a smile on your face.
You should come to the concert and hear the work then. Right?
Yes.
I love the program notes because I love knowing what the composers are thinking about as they're writing the piece.
Yes.
And the mindset is wonderful. Also, I have been working on the piece without knowing that information. I think... You take from the notes what you want. I think everybody has their own reaction to that kind of stuff, but there's nothing that can be just coming and hearing the piece.
Mm-hmm. And if I could add to that, this goes to what we spoke to earlier, is for some people, program notes just provide a guide or an entry point. And it's just kind of like a little, just something to be mindful of as you listen to. But what your experience is very personal, and there's no wrong or right answer to that. It's what it is for you.
Right.
But maybe having this information just helps you hang on to something and then go from there.
James, as the conductor, what does it mean for you?
It means a lot. I mean, I titles, program notes, instructions in the score. I mean, all those things go into my preparation, and the intention of the composer, as stated in text, it means a lot. And it's a way in. I find it's a way in. Sometimes it's a really very efficient way in to making the piece happen.
A little about the program tonight. What else could somebody who's listening to this interview is thinking, I need to get there down to Ermoule Street and to the shoe factory. By the way, telephone number 226638 71 if you haven't already booked your ticket for tonight's concert, which starts at 8:30. Do call 226638 71. And I'm just speaking to the Thalia. It's Thalia, not Thalia. Thalia.
It's interesting. That's a good question. We in the U.S. we say Thalia Ensemble.
Thalia.
Yeah, but in in Europe, everyone pronounces it Talea. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it shows that I'm really more European than American. I'm speaking to members of the ensemble ahead of the concert tonight. Yes, what would you highlight?
It's a highlight. Well, I mean, there's so many highlights. I will just say personally, I'm excited about playing Grisez's Talea because I think it's a real masterpiece, and I think you don't often have a chance to hear this work performed live or contemporary music performed live. You should come out. I think come out in a spirit of adventure, in the way that you might want to go try a new restaurant or a new cuisine, and perhaps I would invite people to come and be open-minded, and there might be pieces that you don't love, and that's okay, but there might be something that you've never heard before that you really do love. And
right.
And I think as long as people come to it with a spirit of adventure and an open mind, I think they're going to have a great time.
There's also the music of Sofia Gubadulina, a Russian composer, half Russian, half Tatar, with her music distinguished by the unusual combinations. I just wanted to play a snippet of Silencio, bearing in mind the silence of number 2. So that was the music of Sofia Gubadulina, and in that recording, the Camerata Transilvanica under Gheorghe Selmeci. And just a taste, thank you all so much for coming into the studio today. I look forward to hearing the concert this evening, Talea Ensemble, and thank you to James Baker, the conductor, Karen Kim, violinist, Dr. Chris Gross, the cellist, and Adrian Morajon, bassoonist and executive director. Thank you all so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.